to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and I'm joined this evening once again by Brian. Hey, Brian, how you doing tonight?
Hey, Scott, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Kind of had a weekend where I think I spent more time sleeping than anything else, which is a little uncommon for me. So I didn't quite get as much done as I would have liked. And what seemed like when I was awake, I was watching TV all weekend, binging this, that, and the other thing. But we are here once again to talk about the show that we can't binge, but we could if we would, if we could. But we're watching it on a weekly basis, and we're talking about Perry Mason, Chapter 7, we are now up to. I just realized none of that made any sense, but who cares? So let's get right into this latest episode, which I guess this would count as the penultimate episode, correct?
Believe so, yes.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see as we get through the episode, and by the time we're done with it, whether or not this fulfilled what we often say about shows and their, you know, penultimate episodes of any season, which is usually, you know, it's quote unquote where the good stuff is. Perhaps with this series, they've been fairly even keeled about distributing, you know, quote unquote the good stuff. And just based on the ads we're seeing for the final episode, this might be more old school, where it's really the final episode where they really, you know, bring the extra oomph, you know, like a show from the 80s or something like that. Or it's Perry Mason, a show from the 60s. Anyway, speaking of time periods, we actually started off this episode with a flashback. I don't believe we're given an actual year. But unless I missed it, which is very possible, but it's clearly, I would say at least 15, 20 odd years, maybe 25 years in the past. And we actually see Sister Alice off in a field. I said it was a wheat field. I know it probably is not a wheat field, but I have no idea how to identify plant life. She's off in a field, and her mom is with the car. They're pulled over to the side of the road. They're having some car trouble. One of the things I enjoyed about this moment, maybe it's just me, I like that when this fellow drives up and is offering Sister Alice's mother help. I keep forgetting what her full actual name is. I know it's got a... they've said it a few times in the series. I've totally forgotten it at this point. Do you remember what her mom's name is?
I just call her mother.
Okay. I mean, I know the actress is Lily Taylor, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. over from like 6 Feet Under and a bunch of other things. And I know her name is, it's got like an MC kind of in it, like, you know, like McGillicuddy or something. I know that's not the name. Sorry. So I apologize to our listeners. I did not put that in my notes. I didn't think to look it up before we started the podcast, but we know who I'm talking about. I like the fact they established they're from Canada, Saskatchewan, I believe.
Their way down from Saskatoon.
Saskatoon. Thank you. I two mistakes already in the podcast. Wow. That one bad review is starting to come true. I like that only because Tatiana Maslany is from Canada. So, and I don't know if Lily Taylor is. I don't think she is. Although that would be kind of interesting if they both were. I should probably look that up in IMDb. While you're talking, I'll look that up just because now I'm curious. But I just kind of got a kick out of that because it was one of those details. They didn't need to pick that area. There's nothing that's transpired in the series so far that really needed them to be from Canada. I just like that they did that because anyone who knows who Tatiana Maslany is knows that she's from Canada because we know her from Orphan Black, you know, a Canadian series. Practically everyone on that show was Canadian with a few Brits in the mix as well. And so... basically, this little moment here, we've all seen it. I don't need to go into the specifics of what happens. I'm more interested in this obviously impacts the relationship between the mother and daughter from that point on. So when we come out of the flashback and they're seated there at dinner with Emily, the way that Sister Alice is looking at her mother. I mean, there is the clear implication, and the way I'm interpreting the even the editing of the episode is this memory is on her mind as she's looking at her mother. Like, the things that you had made me do in the past kind of a thing. You know, and which is almost fuel, in a way, it's almost more fueling the fact that she's striking out on, has been striking out on her own, you know, despite what her mother has said a number of times, because of the things that she had to do at her mother's request or behest or whatever. I mean, that, to me, I thought that was kind of the initial, purpose of that. And then until we fast forward to the end of the episode, so we can, it's almost a kind of, I guess, a bookend thing happening here, where, after all the chaos that happens at the cemetery and they're on the road and they encounter those people with the baby, and again, Brian, I'll let you go off on this in a moment, but my interpretation, again, my interpretation of that is this was kind of, this is set up. This is a setup by her mother. This sudden newborn, or not newborn, but baby, they come upon the road, and this is going to be Charlie Dodson. How you can imagine this fucking possibly could get away with this, I have no idea. But I felt everything from the empty coffin all the way to this were all machinations by her mother in order to try to extricate themselves from this situation, though I don't really think it would really work, but it's an interesting plan. We were trying to figure out what the heck are they going to do. But it kind of made me think the opening scene we're seeing is like, this is the stuff, her mother's behind stuff. This is the stuff her mother made her do. And here we are again. Like, this is the idea of the plan that her mother has. And she, instead of just going along with it, she runs away from it. Even if at this point in time, at least it's not, is it as bad as what her mother used to make her do 20 something years ago? I don't know. You know, I'm going to say probably not, but, it was an, as much as I've been kind of disaffected or just kind of meh beyond the actors and the performances on the Sister Alice storyline, that became a very interesting, way to not just bookend the episode, but have it be such a great point of tension through the episode. Not so much that we ever thought that they could possibly raise a child from the dead. We had the ongoing question of, well, what are they going to do? And also the fact that we knew that this could be certain disaster for the Emily Dodson case, as we see with Perry trying to prevent this whole thing from happening, you know, throughout that whole scene and even earlier. So I was very much attuned to the way all these things were happening throughout the episode. So I will now, yeah, I will depart the stand now and let Brian approach the bench, and he can give his dissertation on these things. And by the way, and if you want to get into, I didn't touch upon it, but if you want to get into anything else as far as, like, you know, them, Elder Brown storming the studios while they're reenacting the crucifixion of Jesus. could you be more on the nose? But, throw that in there too, if you like.
No, I thought the church narrative merged into the trial in an important way, but I'll touch on what you've touched on first. And the most important thing that we see is what we've been seeing, and you and I have talked about, is this codependent relationship between Sister Alice and her mother has been straining, and the mother needs Sister Alice because Sister Alice is the moneymaker. But Sister Alice has went along with her mother because her mother's plots and things she has done has brought them to where they are. But seeing where this ends up, you know, we've seen her breaking away from her mother. And I think there's the other scene, I think, where she looks at Emily Dodson when they share a cigarette out on the patio, and in an instance where she sees Emily weak, she doesn't try to BS her the way her mother tries to BS her. She sort of says, "What is it you want to ask me? Just be straight up with me." I think that she's really craving honesty and craving a new way. And obviously at the end, is just running away from everything when we leave her with the fake baby scene. And that sideshow spills over into the trial in a very terrible way, because Perry has one of his best days in court. Makes a particularly compelling argument that the amount the church owed was the exact amount the ransom requested by George Gannon was. And in tying that together and scoring some points in court, it's quickly overshadowed by the people coming in throwing bombs and the sideshow of it being Good Friday and it's going to be the weekend and Easter and knowing that what's going to happen at the cemetery. So the church and the trial and the issues sort of come to a head together in this episode in a way that you and I were worried about, but I found to be satisfying.
Yeah, I would say it's funny. To putting aside the Sister Alice stuff, and thank you for mentioning, I'd forgotten the scene between her and Emily, which I thought was a very telling scene. It's a very interesting thing about Sister Alice, because she seemed so straightforward and honest and sincere about things. So then you then wonder about this whole idea of resurrection. Does she believe her own delusion? That's what it seems. Even though she seemed beyond that, quite often she's more practical minded, you know, and maybe is even aware of the artifice of what she's doing. But she does seem to be, to whatever extent, a person of faith, perhaps more than many of the people that have been around her. But then again, on the other side of that, you know, when you have people who are accusing her of being a blasphemer and everything, well, that kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, having true faith in as well, because, you know, you don't believe that actually happens beyond, you know, it stops with Jesus, doesn't happen for other people. from what I understand. I mean, I haven't read my Bible in, ever, but you know, I'm pretty sure no one else gets to come back from the dead unless they're, you know, they're on AMC on Sunday nights at 9 or something.
Right.
But getting to the other church-related stuff, and I think this is what you were really referring to, and it's also back to where we left off the previous episode. We were kind of wondering where they were going to go with the Perry and Jim Hicks stuff. And there was a concern, if I'm not mistaken, there was a concern I expressed in that podcast that I'm hoping they didn't get too bogged down in, you know, so many little intricate Byzantine details that it's just going to be kind of like, it's not going to be as simple as follow the money, so to speak. It's going to be something where it's going to, you know, it's going to lose me a little bit. And that's always a risk when you start getting into these things. Cause I mentioned how that's the delicate line you have to balance, or your tightrope you have to walk across whenever you're doing this kind of thing. And we had mentioned this is also, and it's just coincident, well, not coincidence, it's funny that it's also something we see in a lot of either film noir or similar type of stories. I mentioned, you know, whether it be, you know, all the land and water schemes in Chinatown, right down to the land and, you know, highway schemes and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, you know.
Right.
What I loved in this episode, and, you know, someone's probably going to watch this episode, and if they talk about it in any remotely analytical way, they're probably going to, there's a number of great scenes to focus on and talk about, you know, whether it be little pieces of dialogue or how they deal with a plot and character, blah, blah, blah. The thing that that stood out to me, which might have gone by other people's notice, it's an early scene. It's Perry and Della making their way up the stairs to the courthouse. Della is expressing my concerns. And it's like, it's almost like, how she's speaking to Perry and what he needs to do as far as that jury is concerned is how I would want to speak to the writers about how this plot element should be concerned for the viewers. I really enjoyed that because that was the concern. I think she literally says to him, you know, don't get too bogged down in the numbers because you're going to end up putting them to sleep. That's when we get to them in the actual courtroom. And again, I'll just use that analogy when we're talking about walking a tightrope. It was interesting to watch Perry work because normally when you watch a courtroom drama, in whatever format it is, it's we're watching that lawyer, he's working the witness and witness to his advantage, whatever, and he's also trying to work the room or work the jury. Perry's got one more thing to worry about here. He's also got to deal with the not the greatest defendant in court between right. her with her Bible, which he kind of, you know, not so somewhat subtly reaches over and takes the Bible away from her. Or when she, you know, she yelps out, yes, yes, during the guy's testimony about the church. And I was kind of going, oh boy. It's just one more difficulty he has to deal with. And again, this is a man who's never practiced law before. But what I really loved about it is because he's been in court any number of times, probably not just watching EB, but probably watching any number of lawyers and barristers over the years. I thought there was a really nice art to how he extracted the information from the witness. Because there clearly hasn't been that much time from the point where he's with Jim Hicks and Jim Hicks is literally digging up evidence for him. And then we don't smash cut right to this, but we cut to this shortly thereafter. I don't get the impression there was much time to prep the witness, although there had to be some time because they clearly had this all planned out that, you know, the person that Hazel would pop up with the actual books and records. Just the way this all unfolds was really well done. And I could hear the objections before they were going to say, like, what does this have to do with the case? And the fact that Perry was able, I mean, give him credit for being able to keep the judge at bay, you know, that he had enough slack to be able to get there. So I really thought that you're right. It was a very well orchestrated moment. And true Perry Mason style, maybe this wasn't making someone crack on the stand, but having someone like really get up and appear with the evidence in hand that the prosecution didn't even think existed just a minute earlier, that's kind of a Perry-like moment as well. It's just one of those overly dramatic, probably generally doesn't happen in an actual courtroom, but we're not watching a documentary, we're watching a dramatic series, so that's where you can get away with crap like this. So I really liked the way that all played out, and yeah.
Well, it shows that Perry anticipated what was going to happen and laid a trap, and the DA walked into the trap, and we get some great Stephen Root moments, you know, and when the ledgers are being walked forward, Mr. Hicks had prepared to be slandered and to be claimed to be a thief. So he protected himself. Perry didn't go into that knew that ahead of time so that when the DA made those charges against him, he was prepared to defend himself and could produce the copies of the ledgers. And that was a big moment in the courtroom. And when those numbers matched, the 100,000, you know, the church owed to the 100,000 for the ransom request, that was a really big moment for the defense. And then, of course, it's interrupted by the sideshow created by the fervor around the Sister Alice group. So it's but I thought the courtroom stuff was great. We sort of jump from there into a sort of a different rest of the episode. We sort of leave the courtroom for the rest of the episode there. And if you want to talk about that next.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just trying to figure one thing out before we proceeded further. Because he also, oh, here it is. Oh yeah, it's at the end of just to be clear so people know we know what we're talking about, and I know you do, of course. The Perry builds the case initially. He's building the case with the church and the money and the ransom. He's starting it with Hicks, but then he kind of completes that loop when he gets Herman on the stand. He
Yes.
gets Herman on the stand, and who, unlike Hicks, who is a cooperative witness, Herman would be what we call a hostile witness, I would say. Definitely
Yes.
hostile towards Perry, as we had already seen in previous episodes. I was totally expecting him to drop a comment about his being the blue carded whatever departure from the army or something like that. But it's at the end of the Herman scene when the those frat guys show up, where dressed up in drag like their sister Alice, and throwing the smoke bombs or stink bombs or whatever. So it's almost more frustrating because Perry went through all this trouble. He was building this. He was doing a really nice job of it. He was making Barnes look like, well, basically Barnes was looking like EB first half of the season.
Right.
Taken by surprise in public and not really hiding your surprise and your upsetness. When they then cut to the bathroom, I was expecting to be Barnes in the bathroom going on one of his tirades again until I saw it was going to be Perry and Pete. So yeah, I mean, we can kind of shift from the trial stuff to some of the other things. It's interesting because there's a lot of plotting going on in this episode, but there's so many like really nice little key scenes. I don't really think we need to go much more about like the Perry and Hicks scene early on, but the only thing I do want to point out about it is when they have that little mutual depression society kind of conversation where they've both been guilty of being these bad things throughout their life. Perry is obviously looking for some form of redemption. I think he's trying to using this trial for that. And I think Hicks is doing that as well. I mean,
Right.
him getting up on the stand and laying everything bare is his means of redemption. Redemption is a big theme, I think, in this series, for many of these characters. But very specifically, Perry Mason's character. So just wanted to make the aside to that. I wouldn't mind bouncing over to talking a bit about Perry and Pete in this episode, because I think there's a bunch of things in on that ledger we might want to get to.
Sure.
So, I mean, because I know you have a special adoration for the Pete character as well. I don't mind if you want to start off on this one, then I can jump in or however you want to do it.
I'll say that Perry tasks Pete with some very difficult things. Pete's been doing admirably, but unfortunately loses Sidell, and loses him in a way that on a busy street in the middle of a parade, trying not to be too obvious to be seen, after being seen, Sidell gets away. And then Perry gets upset because Sidell could be the key witness that makes that final link to the church. And I think then there's the ultimate confrontation between Perry and Pete when and I think when Pete's watching Perry in court, he sees Perry's doing well, and he himself feels bad and leaves the courtroom, because he knows on some level he's let Perry down. But seeing the scene, I saw both sides. Perry wants to win so bad, because it's the right thing, that he's very upset, and that could be the crucial piece of evidence to complete the chain of custody linking those ledgers to legitimately being something in the church. And again, we see Sidell later saying that we don't know this, but then he exposes his mental state and says there's no way he could hold up on the witness stand, that he would cave. So Perry's close to cracking that part of the case and gets upset. And, you know, I think Pete sees maybe that the Perry Mason that he knew has changed enough and is changing enough that at this point they, you know, maybe it's better he go a different direction, because things aren't going to be the way they were and they're changing, and Pete walks away. And, you know, I had a sense of finality in that scene that made me sad, because Pete's been a great character. And I think Pete has brought the best of his talents to bear for Perry. But I saw both characters' side, but I think Pete really did a lot of legwork, gave Perry the connections, but not getting Seidel. I understand why Perry's frustrated he didn't get him, but damn it, Pete tried. And, I thought it was a great scene and probably the end of a working relationship. Maybe we'll see Pete again in the future. Let's hope.
What I kind of liked about the way they handled the Pete and Perry stuff, first of all, there's something they do in this episode. There's a lot of compare and contrasting kind of moments, whether it be the bookending stuff I mentioned with Sister Alice and her mother. We get something different with Pete and Perry. We get almost kind of, you know, the 180 degree situation. Because the first time, you know, Pete and Perry are together, it's after Pete has seen Perry in court. He's very impressed with him, but he's also very impressed with his own work, to the point that Perry even mocks him for flattering himself. And then until Pete drops yet another bomb of chestnut of information that he's been able to obtain, so really showing his worth and then some as far as his detective legwork, as you say, as far as all the information he's gotten on Ennis. However, as you said, he loses Seidel in the crowd. That was the one thing Perry needed him to do for the weekend, because he wants to get him on the stand, doesn't want him to disappear on him. Obviously, that's what happens. And then Perry goes off on him. It's not that obviously, I, quote unquote, would see both sides as well. The problem is, Perry's already had this relationship with Pete all along where they're not simply buddies. Perry has, I mean, we had seen it before. There does tend to be a little bit of testiness between them at times. Perry does kind of come down on him at times, whatever, or stiffs him, or he doesn't get paid, whatever. So it's not like they have the most ideal best friends working relationship. They're certainly friends, but they're not. But they certainly have had their issues, and we saw that they were pre-existing before the series even started. What Perry does, it kind of reminds me. I'm going to use a baseball analogy, a brief one, so I don't bore our non-baseball fans. If you're a pitcher. Imagine Perry Mason's the pitcher. When one of your guys behind you commits an error, you know, doesn't catch a fly ball that he should have, whatever. There's a rule of something you don't do. You don't react. You don't show them up. It's bad. It causes issues. You don't do that. I was watching part of a game this evening. The rest of which I'll watch on my DVR after we finish this podcast. And there was a moment that was where the pitcher kind of had a look on his face. And as I'm watching, I was like, dude, get that look off your face. Just, you know, swallow your tongue or swallow, just eat it, whatever. And, you know, any reason, whatever. But I kept thinking, that's something you don't do. It's known. You don't do that. And I felt that's what Perry was kind of doing to Pete here. I mean, Perry, whose own record is not exactly spotless, who we've already seen screw up a number of times in this series. We've seen everybody screw up at one time or another. I'm not saying he shouldn't have been upset about it, but really ripping into him, I mean, the guy did what he could. I mean, I was amazed that maybe he shouldn't have been spotted by Seidel so easily. Then again, I couldn't believe Seidel was Mr. Nervous trying to find a way to get money for the bank, still decided to stop for a shoe shine. That was a very strange decision on that guy's part. You're begging for money, but I'll spring for the 50 cents for the shoe shine. But yeah, and I did feel it, there was a finality to it. I also knew, in that sense, knowing who these characters, or at least who some of these characters are, as far as the continuing stories and mythos, if you will, of Perry Mason, well, I do not recall. I could be wrong about this. Maybe I should have looked this up. But as far as I can remember, I don't recall there being a character based on a Pete. What's his last name? Strickland? I could be wrong about this, and I apologize if I am. I don't recall there being a Pete Strickland character in those Perry Mason stories. I could be wrong about that. I probably should. You know what? I will look that up after this podcast, and if I'm wrong, I will correct myself in our next podcast. But I don't think there was. I think the idea is we need to kind of shift Pete Strickland out, because that's the quote-unquote position that Paul Drake is going to take. And when he actually says, you should go get, Dinge Tracy, let Drake take over. Like, maybe he can eat your shit, because I'm sick of swallowing it anymore. I said, oh, this is how Paul Drake assumes the role of Perry's PI, which is what was the role that people are familiar with that character on the TV show as well as in all the books. I will say, ever so mild spoiler, because I don't think it is, because if HBO shows it to you 30 seconds after the show is over, it's not really a spoiler. They did show a trailer for the final episode, and one of the scenes we see in the final episode is specifically Perry talking to Pete about working with him again one more time. So we know that at least in the next episode there is going to be something between them, unless 5 seconds later he refuses again. I don't know. But they seem to be getting along well, so I get the impression Pete's going to have a bit more involvement before the season is over.
Well, there's a theme throughout the episode of, as Perry continues on this journey, parts of his old life are changing dramatically. That, you know, his house is bought by Lupe, and that relationship makes a change. I think after the conversation they had, you know, not to say they won't see each other again or, you know, maybe do whatever it is they choose to do as consenting adults. But definitely his relationship with Pete, his relationship with Lupe, he's changing. And I think what Pete senses is Perry is making a shift from one type of person to another. And that shift's not all the way happening yet, but it's happening, and you see the pressure he's under. And I thought the line that says it, and having done this kind of work, I can tell you, you absolutely have the feeling that when things are not going right and things aren't happening, that when someone's life is in your hands and their future and their freedom, that's a lot of pressure, right? And he's under a lot of pressure. And having a good day and then something falling through, it's not just your ego that's hurt, and it's what's going to happen. How am I going to make up for this and still try to save this person? And that frustration boils over in a very palpable way, and probably the most righteously angry we've seen Perry in a little while. But certainly the most righteously angry about his new profession,
right?
And explaining what he's going through being a lawyer. We've seen him be that way as an investigator, but this is him white hot as a lawyer, and what that means and the pressure he's under at that moment.
Right. Yeah, I would probably say, using your phrasing, it's probably the most righteous we've seen him be in a vehement style since the kitchen scene with Della, when he was going off on the whole thing, except that was fueled more by, well, really pure righteousness and the need for justice. This is anger. And
yes.
And it's fear as well, because he has this woman's life in his hands and this screw up could cost her life. So I think that's all very pertinent and kind of, nails it pretty quick. What's funny is that there's a little bit of dialogue in a scene with two other characters, which I think kind of goes to this. As you might have guessed, I was kind of happy to see Hamilton Berger pop up in this episode again. Very happy that it wasn't just a one-time-only shot for him. We do see him in court watching the proceedings at one point, and then we see him going out, I guess, having dinner with Della. And a couple interesting things about this scene, but let me get to the point I was just talking about. Because Della, as we've seen from the get-go, Della has been emotionally invested in this case from the get-go. Perry took a little bit to get there. You know, I mean, obviously he was troubled and upset by the death of a child and how he's been clutching on those little threads that had sewn the child's eyes open. But as far as, you know, especially as far as Emily Dodson is concerned, that's been Della's cause from the start. And Perry kind of joined into that pretty much after he'd already helped, you know, with the letters that ended up being what's helped nail her to the wall in the first place, ironically speaking. But it's the moment when Berger says to her, you know, has it occurred to her that she might be too wrapped up in the case? And, you know, she's like, well, how wrapped up should I be? And I love the line that he says to her, you know, enough that you want to see your client go free, but not so much that you lose a night's sleep over it if she doesn't. Which, it's one of those, okay, that's, I understand that's how, especially if you're a lawyer, you know, either, you know, prosecution or defense, whatever, you know, you kind of, it might help you to be able to think that way, but it really means you have to turn off certain parts of you. And I know that you are work for the defense, and I know that's probably a difficult thing for you to be able to do. Because, you know, you do end up with these clients that it's not just that you're fighting for, you know, to keep them out of jail. Maybe you might actually care about them. You might, or you genuinely know that they're innocent in certain cases, and that they may be railroaded. All those kind of things can be at work. But I really like that, because what he's saying to her, and the fact is, but that's not Della, but you know what? That's also, as we're seeing right now, that's also not Perry, which maybe is what is going to inform him as being the valiant crime, defense attorney that we know that he's going to be, is that he does go that extra mile. He does care probably more than he should, which is not the way, like, that Berger views things. It's setting things up for the future, because if these two may eventually be in opposition to each other all the time, as they were, like, in the books and on the TV series. So we're seeing that they will have a very different philosophy about how they go about things. So I thought that was a really clever little bit they did there, as well as, whether we want to talk about it or not, the fact of what they now decided to establish about Hamilton Berger. They really are changing. they're really deciding, oh, it's 2020. Let's tinker with all these characters. Who's going to mind? I don't mind. It was just that moment. Like, oh, okay. Interesting. And I wondered, when he refers to Della as his fiance, it's like, is he making a joke, or might they actually do that? Like, be each other's beards. I'm not totally sure about it. I remember what I thought in a previous episode, the thing with Perry and the army. I thought that wasn't really, that was just something they were just throwing around. But then I realized afterwards, I believe that's actually what happened. Same with here. Like, oh, that could just be a joke. He's like, oh, my fiance here. It's like, it would not shock me if they decided to do that. It really wouldn't.
No, I think it shows the juxtaposition of Della and Berger, in that, I think from her perspective, knowing the lies he has to persist in, because what people would do with his personal life and the destruction that could come upon him, it doesn't make sense to her that you would judge Emily Dodson for what has transpired in her private life and use that to destroy her when in fact she's not the one that actually did the murder. But I think Berger takes the more practical view that, you know, the way they see the world is the way they want it. The way he sees the world is the way he believes it to be. But to address what you said, I can tell you that my view, and this is just my view, Brian Hewlett speaking about law,
full name.
You can look me up. If you go to trial with somebody you have advocated for and you care, you have put time in with, spent time with them, that is a human being going to be placed in a cage for a long period of time. And it's not something that you celebrate. It's not something that is a joyous day. And even if they are guilty, like in this case, that lots of people have been affected, It's not something to celebrate. And so I think there are innocent people that go to prison every day. There are states that try to still restrict people from DNA testing. Innocent people are released at an incredible rate these days. The fact that if you just do your job but never, ever get emotionally involved, that's one way to do things. But for me personally, part of my success as a criminal defense lawyer has been caring. And I think Perry, that degree of advocacy and passion you can bring to your work, I think nothing creates authenticity like passion. If you see an artist that really is into their art, that's more believable than someone who is lackadaisical. If someone's trying to sell you something and they know everything about it and they can tell you all the features, that's a better salesperson. The more passionate you are about something, and passion implies some degree of care, the better you are. So I think Della and Perry, I think that's, we're going to see that's what makes Perry better. And I hope that's the way it goes, because I believe personally that's the way it is and the way it should be if someone's life's in your hands. Now, I'll give you an example. I met a death row exoneree, and we had a conversation about cell phones. And the question was, do you let people have your cell phone number? And a lot of lawyers say, man, I'm not giving somebody my cell phone number. And I understand that. But that death row exoneree told me, like, he had a lawyer that wouldn't give his mother his cell phone number. And he said, so you expect my life to be in your hands, but you won't give my mom your number to call you. She can only call you between, like, you know, 8 and 5. And he said, you know, a subsequent lawyer gave his mom their cell phone. And that I never forgot that you can't have a relationship where you ask somebody to put their life in your hands, but you say there's a limit to which I care or a limit to which I'm committed to this cause. And I think that finding that's different for everybody. And I'm not saying it's one way, but I think it's something to think about, and I hope this show goes that direction.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I think that's right, and I kind of suspect that is the kind of the way they'll treat the characters and the subsequent arcs that we'll see with them. So I would agree, and we know we're getting into the season to kind of see how that plays out. Still a number of things I want to touch on in this episode before we leave this evening. A couple little plotty things, and then some couple other major character things. Just to wrap up some of the plot stuff for the episode, in one of the more gruesome moments on the show. So the whole business with Seidel actually getting away, and we see him meet up with Ennis, and that's where, as you mentioned before, Ennis, that he confides to Ennis that there's no way he'd be able to be fine on the stand, that he would crack under the pressure, etc. And even though I kind of think he was going to do this anyway, in fact, I don't kind of think, I am positive he was going to do this anyway, Ennis proceeds to stab the holy fuck out of Seidel here. I mean, I didn't count. I think he stabbed him at least 15 to 20 times. Might have been more. I mean, he stabbed him repeatedly. Which I also believe was also going back to the conversation he had with his partner in the previous episode about it's pretty much tying up loose ends. Anyone who knows anything, kill him. You know, so hence him killing Seidel, that's kind of a major reason why he does that. When in the brothel scene, which I totally want to get to because some of the fun stuff, but one of the little pieces of information we get out of there is the woman that Ennis had brought with him to help nurse the kidnapped baby from the brothel, because it was a woman there who had had a child recently herself, so she was still lactating. He killed her. So he's clearly just anyone connected to this case in any shape or form that could possibly lead back to him, blow back on him and thus his partner and so on and so forth, he is killing off. So that's the problem. Perry's like running out of people he can possibly put on the stand because they're all dead. And he doesn't even know about Seidel yet. So I just thought, since that, as far as just straight up like revelations and action wise, that was kind of a significant thing in the episode. And just setting up Ennis. We already know Ennis is the villain, the villain, however you want to refer to him. It was just, oh, but let's just make sure we remember, oh yeah, he's the guy killing everybody. So.
Right. But we learn through that interaction that this was an accident, and that it was grossly negligent what Ennis did that ended up in the baby dying.
Right.
But Seidel feels some guilt in saying what we did to that baby. And I think if Seidel had any chance of living, it evaporated when he made that statement. Now, I tend to agree with you that I would say when that scene started, the odds of him surviving were only about 20%. But once I heard him say it's really bad what we did to that baby, or what happened to that baby that we did, when he said that, I was like, he's done. And then, you know, that the stabbing was just brutal. And, speaking of Ennis, there is a great moment that I thought of you when I was watching the episode, because Perry says, and it may have been to Pete, I think he says, if I could just get Ennis on the stand, I know I could crack him and win this case, which is what we've talked about, the classic Perry Mason moment, right?
Right.
You get the bad guy on and you break him under cross. And there's sort of a reference to that that I thought was, you know, sort of a reference to the classic Perry Mason courtroom scene that we've seen so many times. But
yeah, I noted that when he said it, I was wondering, is that just a wink at the classic Perry Mason motif? Because I can't imagine Ennis will allow himself to be in a position where he'll get called to the stand, because he's already, you know, I can't imagine Barnes would want that to be the case either, or his partner or anyone else connected to it. So we'll see. I mean, I don't recall them showing a moment of Ennis on the stand in the final episode in the trailer, but I might not be remembering it, so I don't know.
I'm calling my shot. He's not hitting the stand. I think that was a wink to the fans.
I think so too. I am in lockstep agreement with you on that one. That is for sure. So really the only thing we haven't gotten into, as far as I can recall now, is we didn't get into the Drake stuff. And Drake with Perry stuff. So, and I kind of like that. In this episode, we got to see Drake. I use their own words, actually. We got to see the way Drake operates.
Mm-hmm.
From the fact that, you know, even though he is, you know, a police officer, it's not like he could just go walk over and get the case file. So he had to finesse that. He had to, you know, the other woman of color who actually works there, got it. So they meet up at a club. I think, you know, perhaps under somewhat false pretense, the interaction between them is precious. It's really hysterical, quite frankly.
It's great. That actress really has a lot of charisma that meets with him. And I thought that was a great, great scene.
Oh yeah. I love that. I was like, okay, he gets the case file. That's kind of important. But Perry would like to get his hands on that thing. Then we later see him checking out that motel with the pictures of the two known kidnappers, and I loved the interaction between him and the motel owner. Now, there's a lot of ways that could have went down, and we're pretty sure no matter 80-90% of those ways were not going to be positive, because of it's the 1930s. And again, some places it's like that now. And just, you knew. But I give the writers credit. Like, okay, they kind of towed the line here, but they didn't let it fall into total, I've seen that a million times before, cliche. It was close, but they didn't. I love the way he reacts to her.
Yeah, me too.
And the way he I really enjoy that. And one of the reasons I liked it, again, I'm seeing the forest for the trees here, I'm foreseeing if he's going to be the investigator in the future, and being a man of color, especially in the 1930s, he's in 30s and then 40s, because it ends up being an investigator for a long time, quite frankly, you're going to be running into that. You're going to probably run into that quite a bit. So how you deal with that, and in the future, you're not even going to have a badge.
Right.
So I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. So, how do they deal with this without letting remaining calm, but also being kind of funny for the viewers, because if it's otherwise, because those scenes would be kind of a drag to see after a while if they're just done, the drug. And the fact that his manner did obviously the maid, who was herself an immigrant of probably some Latinx, whatever the phrase is this week, blood herself, confirms that she did see them. So he's already, he's barely at work as a quote unquote PI for, first time. He's already getting information. And then when he finally does go meet up with Perry, and then when they go to the brothel, then the moment in the car is one of the lighter moments in the episode. When the whole conversation about how they operate.
Yeah, it's great.
I really got a big kick out of that. Because, Perry's method of operation, which is funny, it's basically, as we've talked about, I think in one of the early podcasts this season, he's very much following your typical classic PI way of doing things. And as we know, anyone who's watched, whether it be Humphrey Bogart or Dick Powell or Robert Mitchum or James Garner, whatever PI you want to pick. Ooh, I hit the P really strong on the microphone there. invariably, they do things where they get beaten the crap out of several times. And of course, Perry gets himself beaten the crap out of. And has to have his ass saved by Drake. And we're just waiting for Drake to show up. It's like, is it going to be a shotgun? Is it going to be a bat? Is it going to be a garbage can lid? Something's going to happen with Drake popping up to save his ass just in time here. But I liked watching the two of them because, again, I'm real, especially now that we know that there's a second season, I'm looking for the chemistry between the characters.
Right.
I want to know, okay, are these two going to be fun to watch interacting with each other? And from this point on, especially there's a difference between seeing two characters who they've already established have known each other for a number of years, like a Perry and Pete. And this is more of an origin story. This is, we've watched them, how they initially encountered each other and how this bond or relationship is going to build over time. So I find that very, and that's the one of the key things about the show, I think. So I really very much enjoy that. I do like that actor. I don't have his name in front of me. Bad podcaster tonight. So bad. But we've mentioned him before. I've seen him in a number of things over the years. And I'm also rooting for him because I think it would be nice for him to get a regular, regular character on a series rather than someone who's recurring or part of an arc like on 24 or something like that. So, yeah, that to me, that was that beyond what's going on in the season storyline, just for the future of the show. I thought that was one of the really important things about the episode, really cementing the Perry Drake relationship. And whether or not he's obviously not officially his PI because he's still on the force, but the fact that even Pete kind of says it, it's not even foreshadowing at that point. He's pretty much saying it. So I really kind of enjoyed that.
Yeah, and I like that you see all the relationships around Perry are give and take. You see that Drake, it sets the tone in their relationship that, like, he's listening to Perry. He wants to help him. He believes Ennis is bad. But also, like, he just cuts Perry off. If there's something Perry wants him to do, he won't do. Like, he has a code that he's going to follow. So the character development of him and seeing the way that they've set him sets a new dynamic of a person in Perry's life that deals with him in a way different than anyone else deals with him. And I think that's something to really look forward to. You also get the throwback, you know, the whatever that you call it, the slapjack or the blackjack that he hits the guy with, you know, with the chain. So, you know, adding those little touches of time and in place, I thought it was excellent. Gives us something to really look forward to with those two. And I think the Drake side of this, the police file taking down Ennis, is going to be probably embarrassing the department in helping Perry win the case. Is what's either going to cost him his job or make him leave or make him decide to leave.
I absolutely agree. If you hadn't said it, I was planning to say that myself, but I don't mind that you said it because you're on the podcast. Because, you know what, if it's said on the podcast, I'll still take credit for it because, you know, yeah, my ball. Yes, that's absolutely my view on how he will eventually be leaving the police force. Whether he's forced out due to what he does or whether it's by his own choice. Either way, I was thinking that. So I'm still kind of wondering what he did with that money because I'm pretty sure he's not throwing back. I almost don't want him to do that. I hope he doesn't ever show up and like toss back their envelope of money because we'll be like, screw that, take the money, man. Anyway, that's just the way I would operate. That's the way I operate. I'm more like Pete than anybody else on that show.
Well, you know what, Scott? Then if you say that, I guess the only appropriate response is, well, I've already seen how you operate, Scott.
Oh yeah. That and still, you have no idea.
Yeah.
All right. So that pretty much, I mean, the only other thing I think I neglected to mention of any note in the episode, just for the pure humor of it, I really enjoyed what let's call it the Poor Man's Kama Sutra pamphlet that Perry is flipping through. It was almost like a takeout menu at the brothel. And yes, I was thinking, oh, is it like a column A, column B kind of thing? I know I'm towing the line on saying something inappropriate here, but I'm going to say I didn't.
I wondered if like that's actually like a period representative piece, like something like that they actually had and found and took, or I wonder if it's something that was created for the show.
I almost hope it's something they created, but it works either way. But I just if I had the time, I just would go back and I'd freeze frame a lot of the drawings because it's like going, oh, that looks like a golden shower. Interesting. Okay.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And then, oh, they're doing the milkmaid thing. Okay. And then like, oh, because it was earlier when he talked about a woman who was had a lot going on upstairs. It was like a math teacher, and when, yeah. And especially it was like, yeah, special skills. I was like, the special skills part threw me for a second there because when he first said it, it was like, oh, someone with boobs. And I was like, Chinese prostitute, but like you don't really see that too often. And then it might have been the picture, actually, which all of a sudden is like, oh, lactating. I did not realize that's where they were going with this. And that would be why he showed up there as to nurse the kid, because the kid was quiet thereafter. And then the whole thing with the revelation about when he's in the morgue and she's a junkie. And of course, if a baby nurses from a junkie mother, as Virgil, our favorite morgue attendant, tells us, the baby essentially suffocates. And it's like, oh, okay, that's probably why the baby looked like it was blue every time we saw it. So I like that they were able to tie that together, much like the baby's eyelids. Anyway, horrible joke for me to end on.
I guess the final thoughts I have, tied a lot of threads together. Good, really, really good episode. I'm curious where episode 8 lands us, but I really enjoyed it. Thought it did an excellent job of plot, continuing to tell us more about characters, and just loving this show.
Yeah, as am I. I'm still somewhat surprised that there are people, some critics who were kind of on the show. I don't know if they'd seen the full season or they were only going by a few episodes, but I don't know. I don't get it sometimes. But anyway, hopefully you guys got it. And if you got that, hopefully you got our podcast. You know what? You probably get our Facebook page too. Wow, this is what you do when you have no script going. Anyway, come hang out on our Facebook page. It's the Series TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Perry Mason, like, what else are we talking about there lately? The Umbrella Academy, Dark, Better Call Saul, and pretty much any show that's on TV now or in the past you can talk about there. You can bring up other stuff too. I don't care. You know, unlike some group pages, we don't really have too many rules. I mean, unless I don't like you, then that's the only rule. Don't. Actually, everyone seems to like to piss me off there, so go ahead and piss me off too. You can also find us on iTunes or Apple Tunes or whatever the hell it's called now. Look for us there. It's Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed and rate and review us. You can also just find our entire archive of 260. What number is this one? 265. I think this is number 265. All 265 of our podcasts on stvdpodcast.podbean.com. Everything I just said is spelled just the way it sounds. And you can go all the way back to the very beginnings if you want to hear, like, me and Dan, you know, in each one of your ears, since we couldn't even figure out how to do that with our audio when we first started talking about Mad Men. There's actually, you know what? There's actually some good podcasts if you go over the years, you know, a lot of crappy ones, but there are some good ones. Trust me. The audio, maybe not so good, but, you know, give us a break. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. STVD, of course, as in Serious TV Drama. Okay, so Brian and I will return to record next Sunday night and thus be uploaded next month, the following Monday morning, the final chapter in season one of Perry Mason. There are at least, to my knowledge, three different possible one-off podcasts I would like to pull off sometime in the next week or two, tops. One I've discussed with Brian here about doing one on Doom Patrol, which you guys can find on HBO Max. If you haven't watched the show yet, we both highly recommend it. I know some folks don't like superhero shows. It's not... I don't know how else to say this. It's not really a superhero show. That's not the way to think of this. So I don't know how else to say that. Calling it a superhero show is kind of like calling The Handmaid's Tale a science fiction show. Although technically it's a dystopian future, so technically that would fall under the category of science fiction. But are any of you thinking it's science fiction when you're watching that show? No. So neither is this.
It's a drama with superheroes.
Yes. Yeah, put it that way. If you were able to watch Watchmen, you can watch a show like this. If you were able to watch Legion, you're able to watch a show like this. If you had a problem with either of those shows, maybe you shouldn't watch this show. And this show's actually funnier than both of those two combined because those shows weren't really known for their laughs. Anyway, so we're going to do Doom Patrol at some point soon. I don't know if we're going to do it before the final episode of season 2, which is this week, or we're going to do something, we're going to do it after. I don't even know if I care at this point when we do it. But I just want to do it. That's what she said. And, secondly, I'm hoping to do a podcast with a former STVD stalwart, Jason, who participated in many of our most, if not all of our, superhero. There you go, superhero. Related ones. This is more of a superhero show that I'm about to mention. This one don't watch if you're not into superheroes. Stargirl. It's a lot of fun. If you are into superhero stuff, it's surprisingly good. It's a CW, maybe it's because it was originally a DC Universe show, which then kind of got bumped over onto the CW as opposed to just being a purely CW show. Maybe that's why it's maybe a notch or two or three better than the typical CW DC show. At least that's the way I'm thinking of it right now. But we're hoping to do that. That is also, down to their last two episodes. I don't know if we're going to do a podcast about that when the season is over, or we're going to try to do it before the final episode, so at least we can try to like make some predictive call our shot kind of things. And finally, there is a reasonable chance, hell with it, I may have just convinced, but as a slightly joking, Kimber, who some of you who listened to that podcast we did about Crown season one, you know, the one where we were supposed to do one about season two and we never did, Kimber actually was on board with us for that one. He's a friend of mine from my old office days, fellow geek and also, you know, fairly reasonably astute guy with TV stuff, with my assistance. No, I'm just kidding. That's not true at all. But he's really excited about Umbrella Academy, and I just finished it this weekend. He's midway through it, so we may do one for that. Why not? Because, you know, because you know what? After all these shows are over in the next couple of weeks, I don't know what we're going to do next, because with the COVID-19 and everything else, I don't know when shows are coming back.
Yep. It's sad. And let me say, since we're doing bonus content, the one thing Scott and I've talked about a lot is Better Call Saul. And if you're a Better Call Saul fan, and you saw the Emmy nominations, fuck the Emmys. The fact that Ray Seahorn can't get nominated is a travesty, and we both have loved that show. Love everyone on it, but in particular, her work should have been recognized at some point, and it's just a damn shame it hadn't been.
Well, specifically, especially this season, I mean, quite frankly, how is it possible? First of all, there's number one, how is it possible that Ray Seahorn has not been nominated at all? Especially.
Exactly.
Now, so that's clearly, I would put that as the number one, are you kidding me?
Exactly.
Number two, Odenkirk wasn't nominated. He has been nominated before. I would say, I submit, his best work on the show was this season. And this is the season you don't nominate him for? And I'm sorry, I've looked at the other nominees in the categories they would have popped up in. There's no way you can convince me either one of those people shouldn't have shown up. Ray Seahorn may get screwed a little bit because there's always the, oh, do we put her in the lead category or do we put her in the supporting category? And from what I understand, I believe they submitted her in the supporting category, perhaps foolishly thinking that would give her a better shot at a nomination. That's, by the way, I don't think that's ever true. There's always way more contention in the supporting categories than the lead categories. I would always say, go for the lead. Go for the lead, man. I mean, it screwed Nicholson back in 1989 for Batman. It screwed Rhea Seahorn in 2020 for Better Call Saul. Sorry, look at that. I got connected to Jack Nicholson. I'm amazing. So while there were a few things to kind of go, ooh, about the Emmy nominations, I'm sorry, that to me, that's one of the biggest travesties in recent memory with them, you know, to consistently not nominate her, despite the fact that she gets as much, if not more, critical plaudits than anyone else working. And it's just insane. And then the one time you don't nominate him, are you kidding?
Yep.
You know,
well, I didn't want to derail us, but since we've covered that show quite a bit and this is the week that we're doing this podcast, and you and I have talked quite a bit and done a Better Call Saul podcast, that I want to be clear in our support, love, admiration for Rae Seahorn, and that it just is insane that she's never been nominated. But this season, is just a capstone of great work for her. It's a shame she never has been. But if not this season, I mean, you know, it's just crazy, and we love her. And I just want to put that out there that we love her work. We love that show. And the Emmys really screwed the pooch on this one.
Yeah, basically, I think the only way she'll ever get a goddamn nomination for the show is if she leaves the show, then she shows up again, and they just list her as a guest actor.
Right.
Then she'll get nominated or possibly win. Because that was the situation with Michael McKean.
Right.
Like, they wouldn't nominate him. And I was like, are you kidding me? The work he did on that show, especially that his final season on the show, amazing. This is a guy, especially someone who was known as a comedic actor for most of his career. This is what he pulled. Don't get me started. I'm too late.
I know I derailed us, but I had to say it. So
that's all right. Whatever. God damn it. But the Mandalorian got nominated. What the hell? It's a good show, but best. Anyway. All right. So after all that, oh, man, we were so close to being done in an hour. All right, my fault. So thank you, Brian. Thank you for bringing that up so I can end the podcast on an angry note. got me feeling like I'm Perry on a Pete now.
That's how I operate.
And I'm hitting those P's again. Perry. Pete. How's that sound in your headphones, motherfuckers?
Outstanding.
Whatever. Oh, no, maybe we won't crack 30 downloads for this podcast. I don't give a fuck. Anyway, once again, Brian, thank you so much for joining me on our Perry Mason podcast. I look forward to hanging out with you again for our next one, and eventually the Doom Patrol one as well, which at this point will probably end up being 18 hours. No, it won't be that long. I have a scheme how to keep that one short. So good night to everybody out there. And I'll let you say the final good night before I click the button.
Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
And now I'll click the button.